Hello, welcome to J Talks Live. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. I'm the host of this webcast series. I'm also the host of the CBC podcast, More. My guest today is Nathan Vanderclip, who's going to share his insights on China's COVID-19 measures and tell us what it's like to report in this new environment. Now, before I speak with him, the Canadian Journalism Foundation wants to thank for its generosity the J Talks series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, and in-kind supporter, Cision. Now, if it's your first time joining us, there are some helpful notes about this webcast. If your internet quality is poor, you can click on switch stream and the video quality will decrease, but the audio will remain the same. If you're having any technical issues, you can click on request help at the top right corner of the webcast page and someone will respond to you via email. This webcast will be 40 minutes long. I will chat with Nathan first before taking your questions, but feel free to submit your questions anytime during the conversation. Just use the questions tab. And if you want to tweet about this, and we hope you do, the hashtag is JTalksLive. Now to our guest. Joining us from Beijing is Nathan Vanderclip. He is the Asia correspondent for the Globe and Mail. He has tracked the pandemic from the beginning. He has an eye on the issues arising as the country emerges from its post-lockdown life. So let's get to it. Hello, Nathan. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, so much has happened that we lose track of numbers. So maybe to start, can you just remind us how big and how deadly COVID-19 has been for China?
Well, for China, the numbers that the most recent numbers that they've got in China are 83,000 cases and 4,600 deaths. And you'll notice if you're paying close attention to the Canadian numbers that Canada is now creeping very close to those full Chinese numbers. Canada's current death count is just over 4,200. It's not going to be long now before the death toll in Canada eclipses that in China.
And can we trust those numbers, or are those numbers too low?
In fairness, I think this is a question that can be asked of any country. And the fact that we are seeing countries around the world doing testing of old cases dating back weeks and months before, and finding sort of confirmed cases based on samples that were taken from back then, suggests that nobody has the accurate numbers. Has China manipulated the numbers in a way to make them inaccurate? There's plenty of reason to say that China manipulates numbers for political ends. There's been all sorts of evidence for that in terms of China's economic numbers. I guess what I would say would be, and there was also a revision of the Chinese numbers about 2 weeks ago that created an exactly 50% jump in the number of cases in the Wuhan area, which is at the epicenter of this. And the fact that it was an exactly 50% jump, I think raised a lot of suspicions. There's been other questions about the accuracy of the death numbers that were released in Wuhan, in part because, for example, when people were allowed to retrieve the remains of their loved ones, there were pictures that were taken at some of the crematoria that showed large numbers of boxes of remains, numbers that were so large that they cast into question the official numbers. So there are a number of points of evidence that would suggest that the Chinese numbers are not perfectly accurate and may in fact have been subject to some sort of manipulation. What I would say is, I think it also seems, judging if by nothing else than by sort of the actions of the authorities here, that the numbers have tended to be directionally true, so that there was obviously quite a large flare-up at the outset, and then that was suppressed, and that now it is a much lighter outbreak in China. The official numbers would suggest it has almost disappeared from China, and that at the very least is directionally true.
And am I right in understanding that the Chinese government now sees the greatest threat with COVID coming from outside of China, from abroad?
Yeah, and that's been true for some time now. There's this language that's being used in China about imported cases. And many of those cases are in fact, and have been Chinese travelers, even from the outset, Chinese travelers or Chinese citizens traveling from other countries coming back to China. Now, all of the imported cases, or virtually all of them, are Chinese citizens because China, like many other countries, has banned entry of foreign citizens. So virtually, with the exception of perhaps a few diplomats and others in special circumstances, virtually the only people coming back to China right now are Chinese citizens.
At the very height, remind us how extensive restrictions have been.
So I live in Beijing, and Beijing had restrictions that in some ways lasted longer than other places, but were not as strict as in other places. Wuhan, obviously, at the epicenter, had some of the strictest measures. And in Wuhan, you had people who were made to stay in their homes for more than 2 months. Some were allowed out occasionally to buy groceries and that sort of thing, but effectively locked down for more than 2 months. In some places, you had people forcibly locked into their homes by sort of police and other authorities coming. And in some cases, there was video of people being chained into their homes. But in many cases, and I think the vast majority of cases, there was a great deal of voluntary compliance. There was a great deal of fear that circulated and a great deal of compliance across China. What struck me, I think, was how widespread the measures were, because it wasn't just Wuhan. It was almost everywhere you could look in China. At one point, I decided just to see what it was like kind of at the four compass points of China. And I called sort of small kind of villages up near the border with Russia, in far western China, down in southern China, near the borders with Laos and Myanmar. And at these places, some of these places, almost 3,000 kilometers from Wuhan, these small areas were under complete lockdown. In ways similar to Wuhan, even in Beijing. Beijing is more of a city-state in some ways than a city itself, and there are many villages that surround Beijing. Those villages were not open to non-residents until this past weekend. That finally was relaxed this past weekend. But even then, there's still check stops in some of those villages, checking people who are coming in. So the measures were incredibly widespread, and in many cases quite strict.
And what about foreigners coming back in, people working in China who came back in? What kind of quarantine restrictions were there or are there?
So right now, I mean, it's very, very difficult for foreigners to come back in, but anybody coming from abroad has to quarantine for 2 weeks at least. People coming to Beijing can't actually fly back directly into Beijing. They have to fly into something like a dozen adjacent cities. But what we see now is this fear of imported cases has been translated into a fear of foreigners, and the governments in Beijing and elsewhere have sought to put out official statements saying everybody needs to be treated the same, but that hasn't always translated. And so we've seen over the last couple of weeks members of the African community down in southern China in Guangzhou being barred access to hotels and restaurants and grocery stores, which created quite a crisis between China and several African countries who were trying to act on behalf of their people who were being discriminated against because of their skin color. At one point, there was even a McDonald's in Guangzhou who posted a sign saying no black people allowed. And in Beijing too, we've seen lots, not, I wouldn't say lots, but a fair number of establishments, gyms, restaurants, and others who have said no to foreigners. So there's a real fear of sort of others and how others could be bringing in sort of the dangers of infection. And I don't think that is exclusive to China. I think we've seen that in all kinds of places around the world. But in China, it is blended with a sense of success, this idea that China as a country suffered by being the first to shut down its economy, by having this very widespread shutdown, and this fear that now foreigners are going to come and undo all the effort that took place here.
And in line with that, in terms of foreigners coming in, when people have been quarantined, how much surveillance have they been under? Like, do they seal their doors? What do they do?
Yeah, Yeah, literally. I have friends in Beijing who came in from abroad, and they live in a house with a front and a back door. They have a yard, but the doors of their house were taped shut, were sealed shut. In other cases, you've had people who have had magnetic alarms placed on their doors, which would sound an alarm when their doors were triggered. In some cases, they were only allowed to open that door a certain number of times per day, for example, to put garbage outside, after which it would sound an alarm. So there's been all sorts of different ways that have been used. In some places, cameras have been placed outside people's doors, cameras that are equipped with sort of like sound surveillance technology that would sound an alarm and alert authorities if, for example, somebody opened their door and walked out. People who've been placed in hotels have been told they're not allowed to go out, not allowed to open their doors, this sort of thing. So yes, there's been a great deal of that.
And so what is life like in Beijing now? What, like, how much has been lifted? What do you see? How do you live? All of that.
Yeah. So Beijing and Beijing's strikingly normal relative to the rest of the world. It's an odd sort of normal. It's a controlled sort of normal right now, but it is much more normal than many of the places where people who are watching this might be right now. And so traffic's back. The smog is back. It's quite smoggy outside today. Many of the tourist attractions have reopened. Many of the restaurants have reopened. There are all sorts of restrictions, though. So, for example, this past weekend, which was a holiday weekend here, I went out to sort of an area in sort of where the Great Wall, the unrenovated Great Wall runs through. And to go there meant going through check stops, still registering with police because we were spending the night out there. And if you go into even like a shopping mall, there's a place across the way from where we live here that has a number of restaurants in it. And if you go there, first of all, you have to show an app that shows a green code. If it shows a green code based on your recent travel and where you've been, et cetera, it will they'll let you in. But then there's actually a second app that you have to use to register your information, including your name, your passport, and your phone number before you can enter this area, even if you just want to run in and grab a quick bite to eat and leave. And you see that everywhere, this idea of registering and having temperature checks and that sort of thing. It's become sort of an involuntary reflex. If you want to enter any space in Beijing right now, you sort of submit your wrist for one of these infrared temperature scans before you can go anywhere. They're not particularly accurate, by the way. At the outset, there were people who were getting readings of like 22 degrees Celsius, which I think puts you firmly in the dead camp. But that was successful because that didn't indicate a fever. So people being left in. But there is still a huge effort to sort of monitor people in terms of tracking their movements and in terms of trying to keep an eye on this notion of body temperature that is really quite pervasive.
And well, and in line with that, then talk to me a little bit more about the kind of surveillance, how open Chinese citizens are to having this happen, having these apps be used, or what else? Like, is this stuff kept? Can they be tracked on other levels?
Who knows? Who knows if it's kept? I mean, one of the first sort of foreign reports on the one of the most popular apps that's being used in terms of generating these codes. And there's three codes. There's a green code, there's a yellow code, and there's a red code. A green code means you're basically free to go. Yellow code means that you're meant to stay at home for home quarantine. And a red code means that you're meant to be in centralized quarantine, which tends to be in a hotel where you can be monitored. And the decision-making behind how that code is generated is done by it through artificial intelligence, which it collates a bunch of different information. It's not known exactly what criteria are used there. And I find that quite extraordinary, to be honest. You have decisions that are being made on people's freedom based on artificial intelligence. And at one point, about 3 weeks ago now, something happened. It's not clear whether it was a test or a glitch, people in Beijing, foreigners in Beijing, woke up on a Sunday morning and checked their app, and it had gone yellow. And this appeared to be thousands of people. And it didn't appear to be targeted anyway. It was journalists. It was sort of spouses of foreign executives. It was diplomats. It was just about everyone. All of a sudden, everybody went yellow, which meant that all of a sudden, everybody was being told by this app that they couldn't leave their homes. And people, understandably, started freaking out. They were quite concerned about what this meant. And a few hours later, all of a sudden, the app reset, had people re-enter their information, and then the codes went green again. But to me, it was just a striking example of what can happen when you have such, you know, it's a pretty fundamental decision in terms of whether a person is free to move about, and what can happen if that is trusted to a piece of software.
I'm wondering what we can learn from that then, because, you know, we have far more concern, or at least we voice far more concern about privacy issues with our own governments. We're talking about some kind of system, you know, to live a pre-COVID life in North America, in Europe. What can we learn from this? What do we have to be wary of?
Yeah. And I said I didn't answer your previous question, which was one of acceptance. And I think that acceptance question is just, if you want to live in Beijing right now, you don't have a choice. So this app that generates these three codes, I resisted until I think last week. I was just like, I don't really want to use this app. But at that point, it just became impossible to live without it. I mean, I couldn't go to the places I wanted to go to without it. And so if it's impossible to do, one just doesn't. What does it mean for others, and what can we learn? I mean, you know, I think it's difficult because the history of pandemics is one where you've seen outbreaks that have tended to come in waves, and the history of how those waves functioned in 1918, 1919 with the Spanish influenza is a very frightening one, because the second wave was much more deadly and killed enormous numbers of people. And so my sense is what's underway right now is an experiment on whether some of these tools of modern technology, in terms of using phones through Bluetooth signals to detect which person has been near which person, and if you've been near a person who was potentially a carrier, your phone can be used to warn you and give you an early sense of that, and using your phones to track where you've been and that sort of thing. To point out who might be at risk of infection and then can perhaps get early treatment. There is a power in that technology to be able to try to forestall a second wave, to try to keep a lid on this pandemic until something more durable can be found, which is likely to be a vaccine. And so, but of course, there's all sorts of questions about who gets the data. How is it stored? How long is it stored? Those aren't questions that really got anything of a public airing in China, but I think those are the questions that should drive policymakers in Western countries. And they should probably, there should probably also be questions about, in terms of when there are corporations involved in developing the software, you know, what information goes to whom, and that sort of thing. And they're tricky questions. And I think they're legitimate questions, because anytime you start to use a piece of universal technology, and at this point, phones are basically universal technology, as an overt tool of surveillance that's monitoring people's movements, I mean, you have made a significant infringement on their rights as a person. And the question is, can the majority of people accept that as a sacrifice in the name of broader health goals? And I would suspect you'd probably get a fair amount of agreement to that. But then how long is that going to last? And this question of how long it's going to last, I think, is a very critical one.
And then we talk about policy. We can't talk policy and pandemic without the real hard politics. You have reported that China sees itself not as a developing nation, but as a rival superpower. And I want to hear from you how that's driving China's international and domestic political approaches right now related to COVID.
Well, it's one where you're seeing China take what I think is quite an extraordinary bold line, an extraordinarily assertive line in terms of pushing back at any narrative that would suggest that China was in some ways at fault for this. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is, of course, domestically, this is a single party state, and that party is perennially concerned with ensuring that its own citizens don't question its performance, and that's a fundamental concern for the party here. And another is China has interests around the world right now, and China is very, very eager to ensure that it is not punished in some ways in terms of how it is treated by other countries. And so there's been this extraordinary pushback that's involved what I think most people would consider to be very undiplomatic language by Chinese diplomats in all kinds of places. And you're having Chinese diplomats, the last I heard, in something like a half dozen European countries that have been officially called in for diplomatic demarches to be told off for some of the language that they've been used to criticize. You've had the daily press briefing, which takes place here with the Chinese foreign ministry, being one where there are really sort of extraordinary language that's being used. Today, the Chinese foreign ministry outright called Mike Pompeo a serial liar who is manufacturing lies to cover up other lies in terms of what he's talking about with the origins of the virus in China. And so that notion of China acting as a country that will cede no ground to others is something that has been building in China, but has been given much fuller expression in the time of this pandemic.
So what are you watching for on that front? Because certainly the rhetoric coming from the United States officials, from some of the White House officials, is pretty, is ratcheted up as well. It's kind of being matched.
Yeah. Hugely. And I think in some ways, actually, the Chinese rhetoric is coming because some of those in China who are speaking out are taking cues in terms of the ways of speaking that are being employed in the U.S. And that's being reflected back in China. And I think that's part of why you're seeing this. I mean, you have Donald Trump referring to the virus as and likening it to Pearl Harbor, which is extraordinary language. And so I don't know where this goes, and I don't know how it's even possible for this to become resolved, because it strikes me that there aren't likely to be arbiters that are mutually trusted on this. You have China expressing full faith in the World Health Organization. You have the U.S. pulling funding for the World Health Organization and calling it China-centric. So the WHO, which otherwise might be seen as potentially an arbiter here, is unlikely to be able to play that role, because if it makes a conclusion on the origin of the virus, it's unlikely that China will accept that. If Chinese scientists publish work on the origin of the virus, there are going to be questions raised about that, because there have been instructions that have been posted that anything, even in scientific papers that describes the origin of the virus, needs to go through political screening before it's published, which of course places a great big question mark over any science on that subject that comes out of China. So all of these things are difficult questions in terms of looking at the origin of the virus. I mean, I think that's scientifically, academically, and certainly now politically important. I'm not sure it's all that important from a public health perspective. You know, this virus is now all over the world and it's spreading domestically in all kinds of countries. But in terms of coming to that question of where did this start and why, I think that's going to be difficult to get any sort of consensus on that.
Well, that's right in line with the next question. And we actually have Sarah Everts has written in with a question too, asking, is there any evidence or suggestion that the government is currently interfering in the work of the scientists studying COVID-19? But you're saying they have to, that their papers have to go through a government vetting. So how do we look at the things?
How do we? Yeah, indeed. And I'm saying that's research related to sort of the origin of the virus. There is also a tremendous amount of research that's being done in China on, for example, vaccine development. And some of that's being done in very, very close coordination between companies and the government and, in fact, the military, which is being involved with that as well. Yeah, it's a difficult question in terms of sorting out who to believe, what can be believed, and that sort of thing. I mean, I think that we've also seen a number of links between, for example, Chinese scientists who have done extraordinary work, and who have spent years, some of whom have spent years trying to study the origins of some of these coronaviruses. And we've seen links between those scientists and Western scientists. And I hope we can have some faith that if there's information that is being censored in China, that it will find a way out. We're seeing a significant government response here in terms of the way news is being scrubbed from the internet. Even the European Union published a piece which was relatively anodyne, and it was censored in the pages of the China Daily. They removed a sentence in it about talking about the origin of the virus, and you've had the Chinese government barring people from speaking out critically about what took place and sort of interfering, threatening people who are trying to sort of speak with lawyers about whether they can seek some form of legal redress over what took place in Wuhan. So there is an extraordinary effort by sort of this very capable authoritarian state to sort of repress anything that might look like questions about sort of the competence of the response, or questions about holding people accountable through means other than those that are officially sanctioned.
Given all of that, how do you sort through fact and fiction? How do you gather the information you need to get? How difficult is that for you?
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's very difficult, and I think. I suppose one of the things that we can do as journalists is try to look for microcosms and hope that they can reveal something. So at a few different points along the way in this pandemic, I've just chosen an area. So when China was in the early stages of claiming that it was reopening its economy, the rhetoric was way ahead of reality on that. And so I just chose an area in southern China where there was a lot of factories, and looked on maps, found that the names of companies there and started calling, called 20, 30 factories, and found that only two of them had reopened. So I think that's one way to try to get an insight into it. I think one of the areas, you were asking about numbers earlier. My feeling is that one of the areas where the numbers are perhaps the least trustworthy, the official numbers are perhaps the least trustworthy right now, is on unemployment, because I think the hit to people's livelihoods has been much, much greater than China has been willing to let on, in part because the stakes are so high. If there's an acknowledgement that large numbers of people are out of work, and there are non-official estimates that it's set between 70 and 80 million people have lost work, which even in a country the size of China is a huge number of people. And sort of look at that, I've done work where I've sort of made calls in certain areas to different companies and different retailers to try to get a sense. And when you hear from a few people that, they've gone from what was perhaps a workforce of 9 down to a workforce of 2, and companies haven't reopened after this, I think it starts to help paint the picture that things perhaps are worse than the official data would let on.
And can China have an economic ramping up and recovery without the global connections for so much of its economy?
I mean, it can have an economic restart, of course. I mean, it's a very, very big market here, so there's a tremendous amount of domestic demand. But China's been, China's not known as the world's factory for nothing, and any recovery in China is necessarily going to be anchored and fairly heavily anchored if countries around the world aren't bouncing back, and if that global demand isn't also bouncing back. But it's a big domestic economy, and when you go from almost a thorough halt back to what is an increasingly robust restart, you're of course going to have much better economic performance than you did when things were all stopped.
You've been there since 2013. As you cover this pandemic, did you learn something about China that surprised you, that you hadn't quite registered until the pandemic?
Yeah. I think for me, there was a window right around the time that Wuhan was put into lockdown on January 23. And you remember how shocking that was, because this idea of locking down a whole city and then effectively locking down a whole province, Hubei province, was really shocking at that time. And of course, we've now all come to accept that as kind of normal. I mean, Italy locked down effectively a whole country. But in that time, when there was clearly desperation, when hospitals were being overwhelmed, where there were images circulating of people out on the streets with IV drips, just sitting on sidewalks with IV drips because there was no space for them in hospitals, where the numbers of healthcare workers that were being infected were going up very quickly, all these sorts of things. And then, of course, then you had the death of this doctor, Li Wenliang, who had been someone who had communicated on WeChat with some fellow doctors about, you know, worrying cases of a new virus, a new SARS-like virus, and then was brought in by the police and made to sign an apology, et cetera, et cetera. His death sparked a national outcry over censorship and sort of the ways that truth was sort of bullied out of existence. And in that, there was cracks in fairly significant cracks that developed in sort of the veneer of official information. And for me, I mean, you know, as a journalist, that what you are reading is in the news, what you're seeing in the news, what you're hearing in the news in China has been approved. It's official news. It is the news equivalent of press releases in many cases. It's officially sanctioned. But I don't think I had personally realized, or certainly not personally experienced, what it might look like to see a more unvarnished picture of China reflected in its own media, and to see that sort of, even just briefly, because it was only brief, but to see that snap into view, and to see sort of open calls on Chinese media for democracy, which was something that happened in the days after Li Wenliang's death, and open calls for sort of an end to sort of censorship regimes and that sort of thing. It was this window into a China that is otherwise censored out of existence through the official media. And I thought it was a really a meaningful revelation about just how much of the official information that comes out of China does not necessarily reflect the real situation, or it's certainly not the hard edges of a real situation.
Is there is there a chance that some of that openness will continue then? Can, once that window's been opened a little bit, can it be completely closed?
I suspect the opposite is true, I have to say. And I think as some of the tools that have been developed to respond to this, and some of the analyses of what went wrong in terms of the Chinese response, many of those sort of revolve around this notion that the tools of managing information, the tools of integrating information, surveillance information, and surveillance can have a negative meaning, but it can also have a neutral meaning in terms of public health surveillance. But in integrating different forms of surveillance information to give a better image to authorities of what's going on, there's been a lot of work, even in terms of facial recognition technology. There's a huge scramble by some of the companies working in that area to try to buttress their algorithms so that they do a better job of identifying people who are wearing masks. And that, of course, is only going to strengthen the skill of those systems at identifying people and tracking them. So I suspect that all of those things are going to lead, in fact, to a strengthened state control in China rather than a weakened one. And I think at the outset, sort of in those early days, my feeling was that it was likely also to have strengthened dissatisfactions with that system. But I'm no longer sure that's true, because I think there has been a real sense, and this of course has been driven in part by the official media, but I think it's also fairly genuine for large numbers of people, this sense that yes, some of the methods were tough, yes, there was suffering, but that suffering was a joint effort to beat a public health pandemic, and if you look at how China has been able to sort of restart things relative to the ongoing mess that we're seeing in all kinds of parts of the world, I think there's a fairly strong sense in China that the ends justified the means on that. So I'm not sure how much you're going to see some of those things that I was talking about, sort of that look into the cracks in the system, how much that is going to actually augment feelings of dissatisfaction, such as they exist long term.
Mm. What about freedom of movement? David Gorman has sent in a question. Rail and air travel, have they returned and are they at pre-COVID levels?
No, they're nowhere near pre-COVID levels, but they've returned in some cities, some of the big cities. So I live in Beijing. And so sometimes obviously my view is colored by that, because Beijing, they've been very, very cautious about it. It's the capital. It's where the leaders live. It's also meant to be the site of the annual parliamentary sessions, which have been delayed, but are going to be happening in May. And there's a keen desire to make sure those go off smoothly. So everything has been more strict in Beijing. But in other parts of, and many other parts of China, schools are back in session, and sort of urban travel, commuting travel is largely back in many places at pre-COVID levels. Travel is you know, international travel is obviously nothing what it was before. Domestic travel hasn't completely resumed, but yes, the trains are running, the planes are flying, the freeways are open.
Got a question from Kevin Newman. How do you rate the threat to Canadian businesses of being bought by Chinese investors at current distressed prices? Is there evidence of Chinese interest here or elsewhere?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, it's that part of that's going to come down. There's probably going to be a difficulty in some of that in terms of travel, which will have some effect in terms of, you know, the difficulty in people going around the world to do that. But you are going to see Chinese businesses pop back to healthier levels earlier than you're going to see that elsewhere. On the other hand, you've also seen, I think, the stock markets abroad stage a remarkable resurgence. So for any publicly traded companies, many prices actually aren't all that distressed, I suppose, outside of, at this point, the oil sector. So I don't know. I mean, there has been, of course, a desire in China to really spread its corporate, I don't want to use the word influence, but its corporate reach across the world. And this is something we've seen for the last 10, 20 years. And I don't think any of the trends that we had seen before are likely, at least on the Chinese side, to be stopped by this, and perhaps they'd be augmented. So my sense would be if there was a desire by China to sort of, for example, buy up foreign technology, that desire is not going to go away. In fact, that desire may be augmented, because there is, going back to one of your earlier questions about sort of China's positioning in the world, I think there is also a sense that China sees real opportunities, and I say Chinese leadership sees real opportunities at the moment to augment its position in the world, to show itself as a more capable political leadership in dealing with a common crisis, and to use that to sort of bolster where it sits in the world. And one of the ways it is, you know, Chinese leadership for the last number of years has sought to do that is by boosting China's position through technology. And so none of those things are likely to go away. And we may, in fact, see more of that. But in part, it depends, I guess, on the Chinese economy. If there's enough money to go around to do that, sure. If this is going to be an economy dominated by efforts to restart things domestically and use bailouts and subsidies and that sort of thing, that is going to produce a bit of a damper on that.
We're almost out of time. A quick question from Susan Reisler. How confident are you that you will learn of new outbreaks of COVID-19 if and when it happens?
Well, we've learned of a couple already. So I suppose that would give us some confidence. And I suspect we will learn about new outbreaks in China, because the methods that they're going to be using here is to, if there's anything that happens, to respond quickly and to do very targeted lockdowns. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a case where you had a number of Chinese citizens returning to China by way of Vladivostok. So they were flying to far eastern Russia and then boarding buses and taking those to the Chinese border and coming in. And you had a couple dozen people who came across and tested positive for COVID. And there was an immediate move to establish lockdowns in that area. There was one very limited case of effectively family transmission in Chaoyang District in Beijing, which is where I live. And there was an immediate move to sort of raise the threat level here and to maintain restrictions there. So there is, I think, a real desire to ensure that there are no sort of major outbreaks that resume. And I think that's going to mean that if they happen, we'll hear about them.
And just one final question from Jack Zimakis. How do you believe the pandemic will be remembered in Chinese society as things, you know, get back to normal, like down the road?
Part of that's going to depend on where you are. If you are in Wuhan and you're one of the many, many families who lost loved ones and who maybe experienced very personally some of the horrors of what happened, one of the people who was locked up for more than 2 months in an apartment and suffered psychological distress, perhaps domestic violence or others, I think you're likely to have difficult memories in the way people in China have difficult memories of other events in history that have been largely covered up here, like the Cultural Revolution and others. My suspicion, though, is that for most of China, you are going to have people who remember this as effectively a great Chinese triumph. One of the things that I've been trying to sort out is what this means as far as exactly this question, how this is remembered. And I suspect it's going to, in official terms anyways, be remembered as a moment where China proved its competence vis-a-vis the rest of the world.
We're going to have to leave it there, Nathan. There's so many questions, which just is indicative of the amount of interest. And we all follow your reporting. Thank you for all of the work you're doing. And we'll keep reading and watching and paying attention to what you're doing there. Thank you for your time today. And thanks for your insights.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nathan Vanderclip, the Globe and Mail Asia correspondent. Thanks everybody for watching. If you want to see some of our upcoming webcasts, next Thursday on May 14th, Ian Hanuman Singh will join me. He hosts CBC Television's The National from Vancouver. He's going to talk about the challenges for broadcast journalists reporting on COVID-19 and offer a view from BC, which is different from other parts of the country, of course, and it just gives us another perspective on how BC is doing things, and he can sort through that for us. On May 21st, I'll be joined by Chantal Hébert, political contributor to the Toronto Star and the At Issue panel for CBC's The National, to talk about Canadian leadership and response to the pandemic. And on May 28th, Heather Scofield, the economics columnist for the Toronto Star, will speak about our new economic reality. You can register for all of these webcasts on the CJF website. I hope you join us for those as well. Thanks for participating today. See you next week.